This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
What a joy it was to spend the day with Kate Kennedy in her home and town of Castlemaine to record this interview. I tried to cut it down, I really did, but have decided to leave it mostly intact because honestly, Kate Kennedy is one of the very best writers and teachers of writing in the country. Kennedy has published several collections of both poetry and fiction. Her short story collections, like A House on Fire and Dark Roots, are widely studied in Australia. Her poetry collections include The Taste of River Water, Signs of Other Fires, Joy Flight, and Crucible and Other Poems. She is a two-time winner of the Age Short Story Competition and a recipient of the 2013 Steel Rudd Award, the 2002 Vincent Buckley Poetry Prize, and the 2001 Victorian Premier's Literary Award, among others. Her highly acclaimed novel, The World Beneath, won the People's Choice Award in the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards in 2010, and she is also the author of travel memoir, Sing and Don't Cry. Kennedy works as a writing teacher and advisor on the faculty of Pacific University's MFA in Creative Writing program in Portland, Oregon. She received her PhD in Creative Writing from La Trobe University in 2021. Kate lives in Castlemaine, Victoria on Dja Dja Wurrung country. Back in 2011, before I was ever published, I wrote a fan poem for Kate Kennedy, basically saying I wanted to be her when I grow up. Her words have continued to have a profound impact on me, and it was a true thrill to have this long conversation with her. I do hope you enjoy. Kate Kennedy, whose gorgeous house I am now sitting in, it's already a delight, to kick off our master's interviews for the entire year on the First Time Podcast, you, I think, Kate, have to be described as a true master of Australian literature, Australian letters, is that what we say? Poet, short story writer, memoirist, essayist, novelist, and in each of these forms, you are utterly, truly Kate Kennedy. There's no one else who can do it. Also a teacher, an editor, a judge. You've got a wealth of experience to share with us. Thank you so much for joining us on the First Time Podcast today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you, Kate.
Now, I'm going to start in an odd spot because we have been assessing your bookshelves, Kate, since I arrived this morning. And you have many bookshelves and they are not in any kind of order. And I feel like you need some kind of system here.
I do. I need someone who's a Virgo, maybe, who would like to come and maybe put on some music and have a glass of wine and just walk up and down my living room and say, I can see order here. Very faint, but it's there.
So at the moment, we've had a very good perv on the short story section. We've had an excellent look and I've got a number of recommendations already from the Writers on Writing section. But I can see, you've got writers in different spots. How do you work out what you're going to read next?
Yes, that's a good question. There's also a shelf next to my bed and there's a shelf in the spare room. If I maybe go in, there's stuff everywhere, I've got to say. And I like to have a few things on the go at any one time. So I'll be trying to have something which is fiction, something which is good nonfiction, because I find that really, you know, good crisp essay writing really lights you up as well, doesn't it? It's great. Mm. And then maybe something I wasn't expecting that's sort of come into my hand somehow. My daughter's really into graphic novels, for example, so sometimes I just look at what she's reading or something. I'll just be looking over there because the TV is also in the shelves and I might be looking over and I'll just look at the spines in the shelf and I'll think, oh, that's right. That book that I bought that looked interesting that was like a little siren song, and I'll just pull it out and I'll have a little flick through while I'm standing there, like we used to do in bookshops of old when we used to have spare time and bookshops, and I would just find myself falling into it. And that's the kind of way that – and then I'll try and pursue that author more. I'll try and find something else that they've written, or I'll I'll go back to my desk and I'll look at another passage, and I'll just, sometimes they become like a jumping off point to doing something myself, of course, because it's like you're looking at how someone has done something. Another person has crafted something that you can't do in the same way. And there's this beautiful feeling of, I can sort of make use of this like a sort of a scaffolding or a ramp somehow. Like that would be my perfect sort of analogy of what happens when we use someone else's work to make something of our own, is that we use it like a ramp to give ourselves momentum. And then we've made something, and you take the ramp away and your thing stands alone. Like that's always a great feeling, you know.
Can you toggle between those two kind of reading minds of reading for craft and just sinking in and reading deep for pleasure? Or are you in craft mode most of the time at the moment?
I wish I wasn't, but I'm in craft mode most of the time. I finished doing my PhD at the end of last year. Well, perhaps we'll
congratulations.
See
people.
Thank you very much. And I must admit, that's a good few solid years of not reading for pleasure, but reading for craft, I suppose, and trying to write for craft too, trying to analyze and order your own thinking. And you're always reading to see what you can excerpt yourself or what you could use to build as quotes and so on. So the idea of, a friend told me the other day that she went away on a holiday for 3 weeks and she took with her what she called holiday reading. And I must admit, I had a big spurt of jealousy just thinking, I know just what you mean. It's the books that you take and you're sitting on the beach reading, or you're sitting on the veranda reading, and you leave them open there and you're going another cup of tea and you put that universe on hold waiting for you to get back into it. You are sort of creating that story. You go to sleep thinking about that story. I really love that. And I think the way that we binge watch other media now is the way that I like to think of reading for pleasure. Mm. My idea of retirement will be binge reading, you know.
I love that. I feel like all writers should be able to do such a thing.
I want to spend the day in the book, in yes. the world of the book, and yes. that world temporarily. And this is what I think most writers are trying to achieve. I think by and large, we want the reader to forget they're looking at marks on a page and kind of drop into this world where it's temporarily preferable, I don't know, cognitively or spiritually or psychologically, or to stay in that world than it is to be in this other world, which is quite a big demand, isn't it? Because it's, you're saying, I want to make something that feels potent enough and real enough that I'm going to control your sense of time passing. I'm going to control your sense of where you are mentally. So that's someone's perception of time and space. That's a very big ask. And it's hard to do that with fiction, with kind of sense around media. When you go into those big exhibitions where it's all around you, like virtual reality, I think that's probably the all immersion that people are kind of craving for. And it takes a bit more work to do it with fiction. But once you've grown up as a reader and you've got that bug, there is nothing else like it, is there?
Yeah. There isn't. Tell us about your growing up as a reader, because I've read now in a couple of interviews that you say, well, I haven't always identified as a writer, I've always been a reader. So where did your love of reading come from, Kate?
Well, it's funny, I can't remember not being able to read. I was one of those kids who, I have an older sister who's only 18 months older than me. So she was at school before me and she was borrowing books in the library before me and learning how to read and so on. And I've just been going through some photo albums recently and I noticed that my old school reports are all in there because my mum put them all together. And I have a school report from a time that I was 3 3/4 years old.
Oh.
Because my sister was going down to the nursery school and I just used to follow her down. I used to wait at the gate for her, and finally the teacher, this is back in England where I was born, you know, in 1966 or something, said she may as well come in. She may as well come in. So I've got this, like, you know, creative dance. Katie enjoys this class.
Oh, so I love
cute.
It.
And I was only little. But because I remember always being drawn to, I'm going to make sense of those marks on the page and those picture books that had pictures of kids doing things and they were pointing at things off the page and they were looking out. It was like, I'm going to crack this code. And so I always wanted to read. And because my dad was in the Air Force, We moved around all the time and we didn't take a lot of stuff with us, but I could take my books with me. I had this little box of books that was my stuff, in preference to toys or clothes or anything else. And I remember we'd get to some new place and we lived in what were called, well, either it was married quarters or kind of like portables. Everyone lived in the same little houses on Air Force bases. And we'd get to this new little place, we'd be pinning up sheets for curtains and so on and getting everything ready. And I just couldn't wait to open that box of books. It wasn't I'd written before. That was the joy of it, was the smell and the feel and the look of them. They were like, once I had them open and I was back in those worlds and I could actually control the world I was in, that was the familiarity of that world. So as a young person, books were my retreat and my solace. And I loved that kind of idea of, you know, possibly you put your hand through the back of the wardrobe and then the whole kingdom in there. That kind of stuff really stayed with me. I was reading by a book by the cartoonist Linda Barry, who I really like, and she has written a great book about drawing and writing as well. And she says she had a fairly unhappy childhood with a family that didn't understand that she loved reading, and she also loved cartooning. And her mother used to say to her, "That's just escapism. Don't put that book down. Come out and be part of the family. Don't sit in your room. Don't do it. It's just escapism." And she said, if only I had had the language to explain to her that I wasn't doing it to escape, I was doing it to tolerate this world. If I could go into that world, it gave me more strength to come back into this world and think not everybody lives like this. There's other ways to live your life. And I guess that's sort of what I really identify with, that idea of no matter how tumultuous, you know, life was, or you know, new schools, or my dad was in Vietnam for a year, all that stuff that happened, I still had my book. So I was a very avid reader, and my parents knew they could always just get me a book and I'd sit in the corner very – I would never go out without a book. I was – you know, I'll do all the, I was that kid who did all the book reports for the library and made the bookworm with the, and it was just as well because I was terrible at maths, but I had a really good vocabulary. I knew how words, I knew what lit me up.
Yeah.
And I always knew that I wanted to one day sort of join that chorus somehow.
And so joining that chorus, when were you first starting to produce your own stories or your own words? Can you remember?
I can remember, yes. Come high school, I was writing poetry, but very kind of secretively. Because, of course, in primary school, everyone writes, you write a poem, which is basically telling a bit of a lie. You make something up, you know, about having a horse or something like that.
Yes.
That actually, I think, might have been one of the poems I wrote when I was a little girl. It was something about a horse. And, of course, it rhymed, and so it was up on the wall and it got a star. I'd never got a star in my life. It's like, really, I made it up. It's like you make up something in maths and you fail.
You know? You do. But here it is, your here gold it is. Star.
Perfect. I found my thing. So by the time I got to high school, I was very interested in short stories and reading. Now, I went to a Catholic girls' school in Canberra. Not a great library, it must be said. There wasn't a great amount of terrific cutting-edge contemporary books there for young girls.
Yes.
There was basically a kind of Roald Dahl short stories, and I think the nuns perhaps didn't read his adult short stories. There was Agatha Christie, which also they weren't very impressed with, but read those, you know, the plot and that kind of stuff. I could kind of work out what was going on and why I liked it and how the narrative was working and so on. And so when I was in year 12, I actually won the school section of the Canberra Times Short Story Award.
Validation.
Yes, it was. It was. And it was a strange little story, but it was only kind of like 1,000 words, I think. It was very short. But I remember that suddenly it wasn't just my parents going, "What is this?" Because I had my photo, of course, in the paper with the other adults who had also won. And but also my principal mentioned it at assembly, which was like, you know, out of the box. The other thing I remember doing was I also entered a poetry competition when I was at school, and the poet Jeff Page judged the prize and came to the school, and I think I might have won a pen or something like that. But you know what? It's so funny. Years later, I had a poetry collection published. We went up and did a reading at the National Library in Canberra, and Jeff Page was there as the guest. And I said, "I guess you don't remember me, Jeff." And he said, "No, I don't." I was hoping he'd say, "Oh, I
of
always knew."
I do.
That's right.
I
but
knew
he said,
straight
"No,
up.
No idea." But he still had this leather briefcase. I think the school had given him as a thank you gift for judging the poetry. He was still carrying it.
Wow!
But he couldn't remember anything about the poem. So I was thinking, there you go. It's very ephemeral, this art form. You need to get your own centre, and you need to work out your reasons for doing it, because it's certainly, as everybody would know, the idea that you're going to, you know, be on Oprah talking about your book anytime soon is, that gets burned off very, very quickly. You're sort of more pretentious or, I don't know, your persona-based reasons for becoming a writer. As soon as you begin to start doing it, are quickly burned away, which it makes it a great practice, doesn't it? Because you soon realise there's no fame and there's no fortune. So why are you doing this? So finding your answers to those questions becomes almost a sort of a existential thing. And it's such a private thing to do as well, isn't it? It's like you do it alone in your room, and you do often. I still do it now. I reach a point where I'm thinking, why aren't I out having a beer with people? Why aren't I doing something which is more constructive? Even now with the computer where you work all day at something and you save it and it's like 12 kilobytes and you think, what on earth?
What have I made? What? Let me make a wall.
Let me go and do some carpentry or something.
Yes, yeah. I want to build something. That's interesting that you say that about coming to terms with that kind of fame and fortune thing, because as I read it, you know, you had that experience of winning the kind of, you know, Canberra Times and the short story competition. You had that a fair bit with your short stories as you were coming into who you were as a writer. Tell us what that period between kind of leaving high school and having that win and the next little while before you started kind of publishing.
Well,
because
like
you did a bunch of stuff in between.
15 years of doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's because I was a very young student when I graduated and only precocious in that very, very narrow bandwidth. To then go to university, and I did. I went to what is now University of Canberra, but was then the Canberra College of Advanced Education. And I think it was 1981 I might have started. So I think we were one of the two, universities in the country that were doing creative writing. I don't know. Now it's certainly, of course, everywhere, but then it was quite rare.
Yeah.
So Rodney Hall was one of the one of the tutors. David Swain was an interesting thing to do. It was great, actually. And we were also doing media and communications and learning darkroom skills. You know, it was all kinds of things we were doing. Sue Maslin went there, the filmmaker.
Wow.
And she was one of those people who just got stuck into the editing suite and saw what she could make. And I wish I had had that discipline, but I was like 18 or something or 19 and I just wanted to make like an MTV kind of clip with my friends who were in the band, you know. So there was this sort of – when I finished doing that degree, I often think of it like I learned how to write about a poem, but I had forgotten how to write a poem. Something had gone out of my enjoyment, as you said before, sort of the reading for craft or the – reading for immersion. I think there's also writing for craft or writing for a purpose and then writing just to have that exploratory feeling of frolicking around this massive field just for the joy of it. And I had lost that feeling of the joy of it. Not because of studying. I think it was just I felt very callow. I felt like I had not done enough to write the way that I wanted to write or about the things that I wanted to write. I remember Monkey Grip coming out and just thinking, I need another life to be able to write like that. You know, I was just not that person. So I stopped writing for about 15 years, I suppose, and didn't ever stop loving reading. And when I look at it, and I had lots of different kinds of jobs. I went and lived overseas for a while. I moved down to Melbourne. I began to work in community development. I was always teaching classes. I was teaching, you know, youth drama and putting their plays together, and I was teaching adult literacy classes and putting little books together and, moved to Daylesford and would have these kind of open mic nights that I would host and always make up a little song or a little something. And I was always teaching and working on that stuff, but I just didn't think I should be trying to get more work published. There was too much going on and I was immersed in lots of different worlds, which I think is everybody's experience. You could do so many things, couldn't you? You could go to your first job and find out you have a talent and a taste for it and just go down that track.
Yeah.
And never pick up the thing that was your childhood
never follow
joy
any of the others.
Ever again, you know. And as you said earlier, for me it was always about the reading. So I became, when I moved to Daylesford, I got the job as the town librarian.
Oh, the joy.
Which was great.
Dream job.
2.5 days a week. And basically it was just go and find a book and I'll blip it on the machine. Otherwise I'm over here with my book.
Perfect. Doing the research.
But I did notice there was an entry form for the Sisters in Crime, Scarlet Stiletto short story competition on the desk, and I looked at it and thought, oh, maybe I should stop reading all of these short story collections from Virago Press and from Spinifex and all the sort of stuff that was, you know, the Women's Press and so on that I was reading in the library. I should have a go at doing this. I remember those Agatha Christie books. I reckon I could do one of these. Oh, there's different categories. What's a cozy, I wonder? It was like a puzzle. Do you know what I mean? I thought, yeah, I could probably do this. And I really underestimated how long it would take me to get into this mode of, or talk myself into the mindset of, I always think of it like sort of, you know, dancing over to the desk with very low stakes.
Yeah.
That's hard to get into that mindset. You need to talk yourself into it, I think. And I think a lot of writer's block is to do with just feeling miserable on this end of the tightrope because something has happened, some logjam of confidence or ideas that we know that if we step out in the tightrope, we're going to stop halfway and look down and then we're going to fall.
Yes.
We cannot look at the other side and dance our way across,
you
know.
Yes.
And the feeling of demoralization, which of course is really ill-judged because in all these years, I must admit, I have probably not heard too many seriously bad ideas. I have heard wonderful ideas. We fall down in execution of those ideas, I think. And of course, execution is kind of fixable and learnable. So it's sort of more inspiring to think about what can I fix? What can I learn to do as a skill or as a craft here? So I'm much more into the craft. Anyway, so I entered the competition and I wrote two stories in that weekend, one that took all day Sunday, if you can believe it. Took my whole day and was a little bit plot driven. And then because I felt so relieved at 5 o'clock, I wrote another one really fast just to kind of brush off the shudder of, boy, that was like going to the dentist feeling. Yeah. And I wrote one just to amuse myself that I just dashed off literally. I had much more ideas. Once I started, I found I had more ideas than I thought. And I entered them both. And the second story was the one that won. So it was a very good lesson for me. In not getting too weighed down by the analysis.
Yeah.
The thing that, you know, there's a great poem by Billy Collins, who was the US Poet Laureate, that's called Introduction to Poetry. And it must be about going into a classroom as a poet to talk to these students. And it says all the things he wants the poem to do for the students. Yes, I would like it to, I want them to feel the way out of the poem like it was a maze or ski across the poem's surface like they're water skiing, waving at the poet on the shore is one of the things. Yes, I want them to walk into the poem's room and feel around for the light switch. All these great things that we want someone to explore. But he says, but all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair and torture a confession.
Yes.
And now they're hitting you with the hose to find out what it really means. And it's that contrast that I am always finding myself trying to fight against, to let my instinctual knack come to the surface rather than my analytical finger shaking, getting the right answer brain come in. And I know this is a very common thing because everyone talks about the same thing, but somehow we need to switch off that and somehow dance to the desk. And so that first success made me think this was actually really good fun. Maybe that's the missing ingredient. If I could just do it for pleasure, for my own pleasure, without thinking of what I want that story to achieve, it's going to make me relax. And if I'm relaxed and happy and I'm writing about something that I feel personally interested in, maybe I'm normal enough and ordinary enough, I suppose is a better word, to actually go with the ordinary, and other people are going to find that ordinary moving in the same way that it's moved me.
That pleasure is so evident, I think, both in reading your work and in hearing you talk about it. And it's something I've become so interested in. I think Liz Gilbert talks about it a lot. Charlotte Wood talks about it a lot. This capacity to turn up to the page with optimism, pleasure seeking, fun, rather than kind of torturing something out of yourself.
Yeah.
Did it continue then? Could you hold on to that pleasure?
That becomes its own work in a way, doesn't it? It's a little bit like, I think I try and listen to music too, which is, and I try and read other people's work too, which feels like it's working as a sort of antidote to cynicism, because I think cynicism is an understandable, but it's a very easy thing to fall into, that everything's fucked and we're all shit and the world's terrible. Like that is, that's cool for 5 minutes, you know, but it's actually I think it's much harder to feel that optimism or to feel that people are redeemable or that you actually have this capacity and this will to invent characters who are not you, who can be sort of avatars of you. That takes its own sort of energy. And I think that is the turning up energy that is very pure but costly, that spirit, you know. It's hard to fake it and it takes a bit of time to almost talk yourself into that mindset of feeling like I am lucky to be doing this. Whatever shows up today, I'm going to be happy and curious, calm and curious. If only we could approach the desk feeling calm and curious, you know.
I want to get on to the kind of journey to publication of your first collection, because I know it's something our listeners are always so keen to hear. But just then when you spoke about avatars, I was listening to you as I drove up here today speaking at the Words in Winter Festival in Daylesford, a recording of this. And you mentioned that word avatar, and you were talking about your experience when you were a cleaner at a hospital and the experience of being able to write into a story this different version of yourself and something that you did. Can you just retell that story? Because it was so beautiful.
Sure. Well, look, I do think this is probably the definitional difference between nonfiction and fiction, is the invention of a character who is a fictional consciousness. And we can feel it. And I think it's probably true sometimes. I mean, I think always the what they call the narratorial I is always a fictional construct, even if we're writing a memoir or, you know, a travel book or something like that. The Bill Bryson who's on the page is not the real Bill Bryson. It's like a, you know, it's a someone who's an invention. And I think to be able to make a character who's an invention based on your lived experience but fictionalized really does make you focus on the craft of what has to be there then to make that narrative feel story-like in a way that probably life is not story-like. Life is generally, in my experience, episodic, fairly incoherent, fairly unjust, I think, feels really random. It feels like you're being just bombarded with random stuff. And that is exactly what we don't want in a story. A story gives us a little bit of breathing space to say, I'm going to take some of these things, I'm going to order them into some kind of sequence. See, that's time and space again, isn't it? Which is going to make them feel coherent. Maybe uncannily coherent, in fact. But they're going to feel, I don't want to, the word probably I'm looking for is exquisite. Exquisitely, potently coherent in the way they're going to continue in the reader's head. Because what you want is the reader, as I said, to forget the looking at marks. And actually, we talk about this in terms of investing in a character or investing in someone's consciousness. Part of our heads know that that's something that the author has invented. But I think part of our heads are also yearning for it to be true somehow, to give us something, to show us something about ourselves. We're reading to get that reciprocal sense, aren't we, all the time, to see how this is like us. In fact, that is what I'd call the hinge of engagement. We're reading thinking, what are they going to do next? What would I do if that was me? You know, we can't not do it. We're watching a movie doing the same thing, thinking, oh, my, don't go there. Oh, my God, now he's lied. Now he's stuck. You know, that is our kind of engagement, is this interesting world of other people's ethical dilemmas and internal conflicts that sort of reflect ours in a way. So you can get into that whole psychology of that, or you can just say, well, I'm going to invent a character to have these experiences, firstly on my behalf, and then if I can really pull it off, on the reader's behalf. That's, I mean, by being an avatar, they're an avatar for me that I've made. And if I can do it so that they feel plausible enough, the reader also has that feeling of, yeah, that's how I feel too. That's what I'd be thinking in that situation as well. So I had this experience when I was 18 of working as a cleaner in a hospital, and it was a hospital about to go private. So it was having all this work done, and it had this big wing of all these unused bathrooms, these big old bathrooms, and I had to go and clean them for some reason. I think I finished my work too soon and they were annoyed. And as soon as I began, the matron said to me, now whatever you do, in room 17, Mr. whatever his name is in there. I called him Mr. Morton in the story. He'll ask you for cigarettes. Don't give him cigarettes, all right? He's dying of lung cancer. And straight away, my little brain said, what difference does it make? It's his, he's but sure enough, I went in. He asked me that. I wasn't meant to fraternise with the, with the patients who were soon, I think, to be called clients. Mm-hmm. But I did. I couldn't help it. I would just chat to people. There was lots of people and I would always get into trouble. So I knew my days were numbered. Anyway, I got the sack. And one of the things I did when I was there was take Mr. Morton down for this bath in the big old baths and then back to his room because his family was coming to visit him. And that was, oh God. But in the book, what I made him do was the character takes him out for a cigarette mm-hmm. into the courtyard. And it's the best thing she could ever have mm-hmm. done. It's just a gesture of, he knows that she'll lose her job mm-hmm. and she doesn't care. Mm-hmm. And it's just like a little moment between them where they have to go around, the door slams shut and they've got to come around the front and that's the end for mm-hmm. her, she knows. Mm-hmm. So that to me, you know, in real life, I always wished I'd had the courage to do that and I never did. Mm-hmm. And I gave myself in the story, the avatar me, a better ending. Mm-hmm. I gave her the courage that I lacked. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I'm trying to do a lot of the time is not rewrite or revise history, but I'm trying to look at the things that haunt me, that I can't stop thinking about, that I wish I'd done differently, or that not saying the right thing at the right moment, or those little moments. They feel really momentous to me, the small moments. Maybe that's why I've always stuck to short fiction and poetry, because it's not the grand sweep of life that I look back on and think about in terms of, oh, she actually says in the story, that's what I remember most from the year I turned 18 is that moment. Because I think those moments are quite momentous in terms of the turning points and the crises. There is a hovering, teetering point, isn't there, where we go this way or we go that way. And when I look at those now, my antenna is out now for listening to those and having those moments myself of thinking that is where everything changed. That went that way instead of that way. I'm going to construct a story around those moments. And now I look at my stories, the collection that's on the VCE syllabus, like A House on Fire, the kids are doing, and they have been for 5 years, they're doing either a critical or a creative response to those stories. And that's what I'm asking them to look at, is find the still point in the story where things are teetering on some edge, where I've slowed you down and made you pay attention to that, because that is, small as it is and tiny as it is, it actually represents the moment of no return. And every story needs one of those, I think, you know.
Well, your potential moment of no return in this story is you've won this award for the Sisters in Crime. Uh-huh. Like, what is the journey between that, Kate, and the kind of writer who has their book on the VCE syllabus? What happened in those years in between for you to get the momentum up, not only for the stories, but to get the publishing deals, to get it into a book?
You know, the people I'd studied with who'd become journalists, sucks to them. The people I studied with who had become successful writers, and I knew lots of them and we were, you know, I was friends with them, they would say, what makes you write is, well, if you were offered a job and you pitched an idea and someone said yes, you would say, okay, I want a word count and I want a deadline, right? Mm-hmm. How long is it going to be and when is it due? That is the parameters, yeah? Which, let me say, that is time and space, isn't it? Again, it's these are our, that's the dynamic that we're working with. So what you need to create as a discipline is the time you're going to spend and what's actually required. So what is it I'm making and when is it due? You need to invent those things for yourself, even if you're the person waiting for them, to actually get anything done, because it's uncomfortable to write or make anything is a state of discomfort, because you have to sit with it being in an imperfect state for a long time. Doesn't matter how good you are at doing it. It's like someone giving you a saxophone or something. And you might know a ton about saxophone music. You might have listened to saxophone music all your life. It doesn't mean you can play one mm-hmm. without sounding pretty crappy for quite some time. And that uncomfortable state, the people who can sit with that imperfection are the ones who become writers, mm-hmm. not the ones who are the most talented, I don't mm-hmm. think, or have higher demands on themselves and can't stand that feeling. It's the ones who can sit with it thinking, I'm not quite sure I'm going to finish it, but I'll just keep on going. You know, it's like they've lowered their stakes or something. So to me, I needed to have a deadline, and I need to have some sort of amorphous shape of what is I'm going to be doing. And short stories seemed a perfect way to do it. I knew they weren't very commercial, And as soon as I began to win competitions, people would always say, these are great, but where's a novel? We need to see a novel from you. Till it became almost a sort of a bloody-minded thing of like, well, too bad. I don't play the drums. I'm playing the saxophone. Yeah. You know, it became my instrument. And so I joined Writers Victoria, and I used to get – I joined the library up too, so I'd get a newsletter that would come. And I would turn to the back page and it would have opportunities and competitions, and I would look down and I'd think, there's one. You know, the Daffodil Anti-Cancer Council Short Story Award, I'm entering that because Helen Garner's judging that one.
Mm.
And it's, okay, 3,000 words. Yes, I have an emotional authority over that material. I can write something about that. I have something that's not about me, that's about that thing. Mm. So I looked for those kind of ones that had a theme, or if it was the Alan Marshall short story competition, then I would think, well, they don't want something set in outer space, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I began to be able to use my discernment better. And so I had a deadline and I had a word limit and I would just work to that. So through the early 90s, that's what I did. I would say, I owe it to myself by August 31st to have a 3,000 word short story. In fact, if you look at all the stories in Dark Roots, that first collection, they are all those stories that won those competitions that I entered in teaching myself to write.
Mm.
They're nearly all exactly 3,000 words long because I wanted to play right to the chalk. You know what I mean? I wanted to make every word count. So most of those stories were 5,000 or 6,000 words, and in cutting them down and seeing what absolutely had to be there, I taught myself how to do it, how to write a better short story and see what is really – what has valence and what can probably go, you know. So because the deadline, I couldn't mess around and think, oh, but that's really – I had to take it out. And as I remember one time, Patty O'Reilly said to me, it was a really good thing to – she said, you never throw it out. You put it in the morgue.
Yeah.
Keep those body parts over there in the morgue. You can do a transplant later into something else, you know. So it was great to kind of meet other people doing that too. And then that time was passing and I was actually writing. And still, nobody wanted a short story collection. So the 90s came and went. Still no one wanted it. I was now getting asked to judge more and to give classes more because I had won these competitions and yet still wasn't a market. Went and did my volunteer placement in Mexico for a bit over 2 years. Had a life-changing experience there and came back and said, I'm going to have to write about this or go crazy or become one of those boring people who never shut up about their life-changing experience because people wanted a bit of a soundbite. And so really my first published book was not those short stories that were sitting in the drawer, which I'd enjoyed writing and had felt like I'd learned something from, but it was this little collection of poetry called Signs of Other Fires. So I wrote these things that turned out to be sort of poems. About my experience of living in Mexico, just for my own sort of solace, I think. And I don't know how it turned into poetry and not prose. I guess I just kept hitting that space bar. So that's probably the definition, is that what is prose? It's words that go all the way to the end of the page. Anyway, I wrote these poems and I entered them in the Five Islands Press New Poets competition in the year 2001, which was a wonderful initiative run by Ron Pretty through the University of Wollongong. And five poets were selected. And we went up to Wollongong and did this sort of summer workshop. And I remember that's when it hit me. I didn't know what I was doing. And everyone else was really good. That feeling that you have of you look at everyone else's and you suddenly think, shit. Oh my God, I'm at the wrong workshop here. Oh no, mine just stick out like this is terrible. Anyway, mine just seemed like these garrulous, chatty, ill-formed, you know, unskilled. Oh, it was terrible. And I went to see Ron during the residency. I said, I've had a chance to read the other poet's work now. And I just wanted to say, if you want to drop, take mine out and put the next one in, because I feel like mine just really pulled everyone else's down and everyone else's is really, I can see the skill in everyone else's and mine just looks terrible. And he just laughed and said, you have all come to me and said that.
Oh, I love that.
Everyone's come and said that. And he said, I have to tell you, Kate, this is such good advice. I said, but they just kind of just natter on. And he said, you have got a warm voice.
Mm.
You've got a warm voice. And there's a spectrum of voices out here. You've got to put your feet down on the spectrum where you belong and stop wasting your time trying to be derivative to make your voice sound like anyone else's. He said, you have got a warm voice, just own it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And don't worry, you know. And it was such a great thing to hear. In fact, I'd say that's probably one of the best bits of advice I've ever got. One other thing that someone said to me once when I was asked to enter a poetry slam, and I also felt equally, people about imposter syndrome, was like, what, a poetry slam? Oh, my God, no. And I said, have you got something? I said, yes, I've got a poem, but I'm going to read it. I can't perform it as well. And I did it. And as it turned out, my poem was the one that the audience chose as their favourite. And I said, I don't really believe that tonight just happened. And the organiser said, don't worry, Kate, you're a talented, sane person. I'm very happy. I do feel like I feel like a really ordinary person, and I'm sure that the feelings that I have about things that move me, I know that I'm in tune with a lot of other people who feel the same thing, and so say, yeah, that's true, I feel the same thing. I'm very sure about that, that what moves me is really on the median of there's nothing, I'm not out there on some spectrum of seeing things in such an original or different way. The things that I notice. That's the one thing I'm sure about myself. I am a really good noticer of small things. And it's not like I can help it or stop doing it. I can't stop thinking about those little things that I've noticed. And so just in order to get myself to sleep, that's what I find myself doing. It's like I'm lying awake thinking about these things that haunt me or that I can't not think about or stop thinking about. And I feel myself, something happens where I feel myself, it's like I'm putting a key into a lock and the ideas are the tumblers in that lock. Mm. And I'm gently trying to crack the lock somehow. And whatever, I don't know if it's going to be a poem or if it's going to be a story, if it's going to be something I give to a character, a longer piece of work or even a little nonfiction piece or something like that. But I'm looking for the vessel that idea is going to fit all the time.
So that's super interesting because of your exploration of form and this beautiful, the vessel. I love that. Because in fact, that Mexico experience, there was so much hot material in there that that also became a memoir,
that's
Sing
right.
and Don't Cry. So how did you know there was something left over from the poetry? Was it just a scratch, a burr in your head?
No, what happened was it was so hard to come back from Mexico and the culture shock of returning was so much more difficult than the culture shock of actually going that I was looking at all the other volunteers that I had met and become friends with, and we're all finding it really tough. And a lot of relationships broke up and a lot of people, you know, couldn't resettle into jobs, or they left their previous job, or they moved or went back or tried to, you know, we all felt really despondent, I think, at having to return. And I thought there's something in this. So originally what I thought was, and when I spoke to Australia Volunteers International, they said, yeah, this is really what happens. And I said, it would be really great to do a little, to have someone do a little performance piece or something like that. And there'd been a couple of one-person shows around that time when I got back that had talked about, Jerusalem or being in a place that was a microcosmic example of this flux and change and difficulty and so on. I thought it'd be really great to have something that was a little performance piece that somebody could perform at the new volunteer intake meetings, so they can understand that this is going to be a bit. And so I was thinking about it, not a book. I was thinking about something that could be a performance. And I did a little bit of work to try and make it into it. And I thought, I've got to put it into sort of scenes somehow, into sections. What sections am I going to use? Because I have this, what could I do? Could I use images? What am I even doing, you know, with all of these memories, all of these fragments of things and griefs and joys and tons of photos and tons of memories of things. What am I going to make out of these? Because everyone faces that. Mm. What are you going to do with what's happened to you? Mm. What are you going to make out of it? Because that's the way out, isn't it? Of lying awake, sobbing, is thinking I'm going to make something out of it. That's the 11th step for me, you know, on the 10-step process. Mm. And so I thought I'd do a little performance. And then I thought, well, I need to find a structure for it. And I was working in a microcredit cooperative, and I suddenly realised what I could do, which was that all the members, and there were 11,000 members at the time, were able to borrow small amounts of money, but they had come up with their own criteria for loans that they thought were valid for loans. Mm. And these are things that were life's essentials. And it wasn't what you expected. So there was obviously there was education. You could borrow money for your kid to go to school and for savings so they could go to secondary school. When they began school, you'd put 20 cents a week or something into this account. So education was one. Medicine was another one. So you could have medicinal supplies, and also when you gave birth, there was some money for you. That's what also they considered useful and valuable in life. There was home improvements, so you could buy, I don't know, some tin or some wire for your new chicken house, or maybe a flue for a stove, so you could have an indoor stove, or eaves for a window, bag of fertilizer, that kind of stuff, maybe a piglet, bag of cement, home improvement. And then the last two were so fantastic. Pilgrimage was a life's essential, and fiestas. People got into debt for years to have a good party. And there were parties all the time, because you were always getting invited then to other people's, you know, birthdays and weddings and christenings. And also every town had its own fiesta based on its namesake saint as well. So there was fiestas all the time. And the whole town would do things like get into debt to have fireworks displays and have a band and so on. So that was endless. But that was as important as medicine in terms of getting through a fairly tough life. And so I thought, that's my five sections that I'll be able to use, because that, in a very sort of a slightly different way, as a reasonably, well, a comparatively wealthy white person who's been immersed in that world now for 2 years, I've been through my own process of education. I have found this to be quite difficult medicine. I have had to see my own home improvements in a different way of what of where I live. And most of all, I want to really honour that idea of joyousness through that stuff. So I found that I had that, and I thought, maybe I'll just write this as a book. Why wouldn't I? And it was hard to make it that long, because part of me, like everybody listening to this show, I'm sure, there's part of your brain that says, I don't deserve 9 hours of someone else's attention. How can I earn, not win, how can I earn your attention to put you into this world so that you can feel what it was like for me, you know? And why would I want to do that? Why do I have this urgency to make you understand how life-changing that was? I have to write it down so that you can be in that world with me. And the seasons are changing, and each of those sections is showing something that I learned that was, you know, a joyous but difficult journey, I guess. I would use the word journey, but it was a kind of a journey.
What you say then about the criteria and that being that structure. Almost like the key in the structure.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've heard you speak as well about how limitations and constraints are the best thing that we can take on board as writers.
Totally.
Can you just talk to that for a little bit?
Well, I think it's a myth. It's a dearly held myth, but it's still a myth, that the creative, you know, that's as if that's even a noun.
Yeah.
Creatives, the creative mind, our creative minds, love to be free of constraint. We love to gamble and be unfettered and to see wherever it's going to take us. And boy, COVID must have been great for you creatives, just to sit in your room and do whatever you wanted with your time. I bet you wrote tons of books. That stuff, which is just not the reality, is it? If I like a small canvas, I think. In fact, I think what I'd like is to give somebody who would like to find out what kind of creative thoughts they're having, or what they might, what their preoccupations might be that they're going to keep returning to and circling, because that's what you're exploring in your writing. If I was to give you 10 blank canvases and said, okay, I just want you to fill these with anything by August 31st or something, you know, the tighter the deadline, the better. Yeah. That's a constraint as well, because time is a constraint. Fill them by next week with whatever you want. You would quickly find out what kind of artist you were, wouldn't you? Because you've got to put something on those canvases. So you're going to put on, maybe you're a still life artist, maybe you're going to do all portraits, maybe you'll think, wow, all of mine are flowers. I don't know what you're going to, who knows what you're going to find. You have to put it on the canvas to find out what it is. And so if we have too big a canvas and it's too overwhelming, we are never going to fill anything but a corner of that canvas to find out what it is we are even on about, I think. And so I like constraint, because if I say, just do exactly one page, just go home tonight and take one photo to bring back tomorrow, but make it one that's really going to break my heart, anyone could do that. Anyone can go and take one. If I said, I want you to tell me how you feel about the human condition, It's like being back at school again, isn't it? Where we have a big theme that we're given and we're told to write about the theme. That is absolutely deadly, that technique. To say, write about, okay, here's your theme. Because we used to ask our teachers, what are we going to write mine about? You know,
well, Give me something.
Okay, write it about peer group pressure. Write it about war. Write it about pollution or something. And we would have this massive, indigestible wodge of something that we were meant to explore. And you just can't do it. There's a really beautiful quote. I'm trying to think. His name is Richard Price. I think he might have been one of the researchers for The Wire. Fantastic dialogue and research writer. And he said, you don't write about the horrors of war. No. You write about a kid's burnt socks lying in the road. And that's exactly what – that's the same thing, isn't it, that Chekhov says about don't tell me the moon was shining. Show me the moon on the broken glass stuff. I think it is that incredible power of zooming in onto the small and specific that takes us away from the big and generic and vague where we're waiting like it's a preamble for the action to start on this small thing. And that's really – I was very lucky to spend all those years of not writing, working in the theatre. And that's what I did overseas. I worked as a publicist for stand-up comedians for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and I worked in London when Impro was starting over there and Theatre Sports was coming over. And I got a chance to sit – in Canberra, it was the same. I would sit in the bio box and I would watch the audience night after night, watching material that I knew really well and watching how things landed when it was dramatically enacted in front of them. And I think I'm trying to do that all the time on the page, is dramatically enact something and giving the reader the illusion it's happening in front of their eyes and they're actually hearing it rather than actually reading it and processing it.
And I think you like George Saunders.
Oh, thank you so much.
Shall I just do that? Kate Kennedy, you like George Saunders because you're a teacher as well, I think, speak so beautifully about the writing process. So we learn from both reading your writing but also hearing you talk about the writing process. So I'm going to throw a few of your own quotes at you and then ask you to elaborate on what has the most heat for you right now. So these are some of the things that I picked out of interviews with you. Plot can be described in three words. Things get worse. That's number one. Number two, the internal logic of the story must be satisfied. And number three, a good resolution can't be made out of thin air. It needs to be formed from the elements you have already introduced in the story. Can you speak to one or any of them, please?
I'll speak to that. I still feel all those things.
Good.
Yes. Perhaps for the writer, it's not so much things get worse as make things worse, because we all hate to do that. That's one thing I think people, because we hate conflict in real life and we try to avoid it. One thing I've noticed is that people are very squeamish about addressing conflict in their fiction. And yet that's exactly where the character has to go, into that vortex, sadly. And we don't want people to not like us as authors. We want our characters to be likable, and we want us by dint of that to be likable as authors, but it's actually not the case.
Oh, I feel that so much, Kat. I'm remembering as you're saying that about feedback I've had from editors where they've said, stop protecting them, Kate.
Yes.
Stop protecting your characters.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or what I say to younger students when I'm doing writer things, which they're all aghast at, which is put your character up a tree and throw rocks at them, you know, and then throw bigger rocks at them. Like that's what we're doing.
Well, we can tell people, but when it comes to doing it ourselves, we're very bad at it because we don't want to put them through the mill. But, of course, the mill is exactly where they need to go, because that's when the story becomes this sort of existential vicarious experience where we understand the mill and we want to see something change in the story. So I think that make things worse or things get worse, I try not to worry too much about plot. I try and worry more, not worry, I try and think more. What am I putting the character through and why? How is this what they think is the worst thing that's going to happen but in fact turns out to be the transformative thing that's going to happen. And that's, you know, it's not a breakdown, it's a breakthrough kind of thing. In fact, I really love that, looking at that as a teacher and thinking, well, you know, we don't like it, it's sort of unfashionable right now to think about structure in terms of a linear shape. People like saying, I'm going to just experiment with that. I'm going to take them back in time and flip them around. It's like, yeah, that's all fine. But don't forget we experience our own lives and we experience a story in a linear shape. We start it, there's a beginning, and then something happens, and then something's changed. That's the shape.
Mm.
If nothing's changed, it's very hard to see there's any kind of story.
Mm.
So equally, I would say putting a character in a tree and throwing rocks at them, it gives you a kind of a why as well.
Mm.
How is that the thing which is the last thing the character wants, but in fact, in a way, the thing a character needs?
Mm.
And oh, people are so good at swerving around, putting them through that situation. They will actually halt action and rescue the character rather than, I don't know, be thought ill of, be thought that maybe you're a mean person with your character. It's like, actually, what you're not. What you are is you're kind of like God. Mm. You're making something happen which is breaking open resistance.
Mm.
Of course we would rather have a comfort zone.
Mm.
Of course you want to stay in stasis. Of course you'd rather, you know, sit by the fire and think, poor me, no one has it as bad as me, but the knock on the door is going to come and here's the invitation to the ball, Cinderella. Mm. So you better not say, I don't really feel like going, because we want to see you get up and get out of that chair.
Mm.
And so I think because of all of us are now writing in an age of modernism, a lot of those things take place on a psychological plane for the character.
Mm.
We don't sort of write stories too much where a person is put through the mill in terms of going to war or having to clear their name, or, you know, those things are more what happens in genre fiction. In literary fiction, we tend to make all the stress and all the duress happening internally anyway, which can make for quite a static book because the character can be sitting in the bath thinking, oh, I wish I'd done that differently. And it's nothing is happening for the reader. Mm. We want to get up out of the bath, please, and go and try and get what they want because they cannot get it.
Mm.
And so that thing of put them into the place they don't want to go is discomforting for all the right reasons, you know.
Yes, yes.
And I think it's good to, you know, I think we were talking before about all the books on the bookshelf here, and I was saying I don't feel like I always read to feel flattered. Or to feel like, oh, that's the kind of thing that I'm like too. I'm that sort of hero. I don't read to be gratified. I actually feel like I read to be a little bit destabilized. Mm. So when you're saying, do you read for craft or do you read for immersion, I'm teetering between total immersion and destabilization.
Mm.
Somewhere in the middle there where I'm part of my brain is admiring what the author is doing, is to putting me outside my comfort zone, and also marveling at their ability to do that. So I'm immersed in the story and I've bought into the dream, that's for sure, the vivid, continuous dream. But at the same time, I'm also really alert to how fantastic that you've altered, with those little marks on a page, you've actually altered my thoughts or feelings or preconceptions about something.
Mm.
And rather than feeling defensive or angry, my response is just like it was when I was 8 years old and I read that Roald Dahl and I thought, how has he done that? Wait a minute.
Mm.
How did they do that? I'm going back to find out where the bit is where I suddenly thought, I don't trust that character.
Mm.
Where is that clue trail in the story? Because I want to know how to do that. That close-up magic trick, that beautiful conjuring trick of, I understand someone has to put the rabbit into the hat before the audience comes into the room.
Mm.
I want to be the magician who's preparing that experience to create that emotional experience for the audience or the reader, so that when you go, oh my God, that is my card, do it again, that is my pleasure as well as your pleasure, you know.
Let me segue there from rabbits, because what was in my head there is the exquisite kind of resolution and the thing that you force onto the reader in the story Cold Snap, which was also published in The New Yorker, and how you lay everything in the right path in that story so that this kind of rising vomitous tension is happening in the reader, and then exactly like a magic trick, that kind of terrible delight in the resolution. How aware are you of doing that as you're writing it, Kate Kennedy?
Well, not in the first few drafts, that's for sure. I'm sure that's the same for everybody.
Yeah.
You're focusing on voice and making the voice feel right. So it's like thinking, am I tone deaf here? Is my pitch right? You're listening to sort of making the story unfold. And you've got, once again, the beautiful constraint, I think probably the perfect constraint, of character limitation.
Yeah.
Limitation's a marvellous thing in fiction, absolutely marvellous, because it gives us this sense that they're going to act according to their limitation in a way that the reader can observe but also understand.
Mm.
So we're on the outside but the inside of that character. And I can, all the stories in that collection are really dark roots because so many of them were written as sort of exercises in crime writing, I suppose, including that story, that I'm wanting to make you, almost against your better judgment, barrack for the perpetrator of something. So the perpetrator is the protagonist. And that is the literal meaning of protagonist, the one who acts, the one who does something, you know. So we have that protagonist. Why is that person our protagonist? Why are we in this person's skin? And how can I make it a bit discomforting for you? And yet you want them to succeed. They're doing the wrong thing, but for reasons, in fact, you can understand.
Totally.
Isn't that right? Yeah. So I've chosen a child protagonist there, and I definitely thought long and hard about that narrative structure that you were just describing there, where there is foreshadowing, there is setting up, there is a sense of chill in the story, there is a sense that his limited point of view is a little bit awry, perhaps limited in the sense that he thinks he is like a kind of an avenging angel in his own head for nature that doesn't have any way to protect itself. So he's become a sort of an avatar himself, I suppose, for those trees. And yet he finds a way to do something, which is almost a kind of a perfect crime. And it's also first person. So it's kind of intolerable, isn't it, to be inside that chilling small head when, in fact, you feel empathy for him. And at the end, you think, boy, he's over it. He's committed it. It's done. And now he's off to do the next thing. And it's only then you get that little sense of, oh, my God. You know, like it turns the mirror back, I guess, onto the reader, I suppose.
Did you write it? Like, here is the fascination of us down here in Australia in our small literary world of going, oh, my God, she was published in The New Yorker. Did you write it for submission to there, or did they pick it up from somewhere else?
It was so interesting. I would never have had the kind of ambitiousness to send anything to The New Yorker or anywhere outside my little, you know, what was on the back page of Writers Victoria newsletter, basically. That was really my world, which was fine. I was happy with that world. But then when I finally, Henry Rosenblum from Scribe, who I had known because I'd done a bit of editing work for Scribe, said, have you got a novel other than these short stories? I said, no, and stop asking, I don't. The short stories are what I've got. These, you know, there's 12, there's 14 of these. This is all I've got. And so anyway, he had a chat, I think at the Frankfurt Book Fair, to my friend and Louise Thurtell, who at the time was working at Allen & Unwin, great editor and really good eye for things. And she'd done some work with me at Varuna and said, I don't know why, this collection's great, I love it. And she said to Henry, you should publish that. And he came back and said, I think I will publish them. And it was him that bundled them up and had the idea of sending them out overseas to a few different places. And one of the places that he sent, this was my huge stroke of luck, Kate, I must say, because it just so happened. You know, this thing about being in the right time, the right space again. I didn't send them to The New Yorker. I actually got a phone call from Henry saying, hey, guess what? Guess who's going to take one of your stories? And I said, I don't know. I had a four-month-old baby and my father had just recently died and I was feeling pretty flat and pretty exhausted, I must say. Nothing much could. And he said, it's The New Yorker. And I said, oh, that's great. Fine. And he said, you wait and see what happens. It's going to be great. I'm going to, you know, and he knew how he was going to kind of map it out. And he was way more excited at the time than I was. But I must admit, when they wrote to me and said, "Oh, we're gonna," they emailed me and said, "We're gonna edit the story. We'll do it on the. Can you stay on the phone? We'll ring you." I said, "Okay." And I could hear them around a table. There was more than one person editing the story. And I said, "So, is there a team of you doing this?" And they said, "Yeah, we're just going through doing a line edit now. We're just gonna fax you this new version," because they had to change the title of the story because another author had just published another collection called Cold Snap. They said, what do you think we should call it? And I thought, I don't know. Call it anything you like. I don't care, you know.
Yeah.
I
said, I'm feeding. I've got a
Elephant's Graveyard. Anything you want. I don't care. I said, well, maybe Black Ice. That's kind of another thing that's an image that's, you know, in there. And they couldn't use terms like weatherboards or they had to. What's another word for weatherboards? I don't know. Palings. You know, I was just feeling like an idiot. But I must admit, I was living on a farm at the time and we had a fax machine in the other house, in the farmhouse. And they said, we're sending a fax through now. And the fax began to come through the machine. It was late at night. And I saw that particular font coming through, and that's when it kind of hit me it was going to be happening. And I said to the very nice editor after we got to the final, I said, well, thank you for doing all this work on it and making all these changes. And I hope it wasn't, you know. And he said, don't worry. He said, we edit everyone, even Alice Munro. And I thought, it's all happening.
It is all happening.
And I had to, they sent me some copies and I had to walk down our big long farm track to where the post box was so that the delivery guy could drop them off. He wasn't going to come up the farm track. And so I walked down and he gave me this bag that sent me maybe five or six copies. And it hadn't really struck me till that point, but it hit me then. I opened up the box and on the cover, there was a picture of somebody walking out onto thin air, which is just how I felt at the time. And they were holding one of those tightrope balancing poles. And I suddenly realised it was this special issue that was exactly 5 years after September 11 bombings. And so it was a reference to Philippe Le Petit walking between the World Trade Center buildings on air. So it was walking on the idea of something. And I thought, this is actually, and sure enough, it was such a special edition because it was bigger than usual. And my story was the story in that special edition. Mm. And we began to get these phone calls from people saying, we need this and we want a two-book deal. So I want this and a novel. Companies were sending, this is prior to not 2008, which was the global financial crisis that changed everything. I was getting bags of gifts of books from people who were like wooing me, you know, to make me come and write a novel. And the funny thing was about being so tired and being so flat and exhausted, I didn't have the energy to get hysterically nervous. And so we eventually decided to go with the publisher that we did. And she said, what I need from you to go tomorrow and get the contract organised for the two-book deal tomorrow is your novel ideas that you've said you have. It's like, of course I'd said.
Of course you have.
Yes. Can you just write them down? Just give us a couple of one pages of your novel ideas so that we can and then we'll just get the contract all hammered out and then we can sign it and we're off and you can get going with your deadlines. Like, okay. And I must admit, Kate, I had been up for like the – I don't know, 11 p.m. feed for my baby, and I put her to bed and everything was quiet in the house, and I went down to the computer and I opened the desk drawer and I looked at a couple of failed things that I'd written notes for, and I wrote two one-pagers and said, and I didn't even leave until morning to check them over again in case I was hysterical. I just pressed send. And they chose the one that I thought was the weaker story too. The other one I thought was much better, but, you know, they're the ones who know best. And later she said, Henry said that they had a conversation and she said, I think it's going to be great working with Kate. She seems so calm and collected.
Well, this was the limitation of time and space.
Exactly.
This is what works for you, Kate.
Constraint of there's no chance to kind of become a gibbering wreck.
And that's the novel that became The World Beneath.
That's right, yeah. The other one was about the people in custody who were the refugees who all escaped and then tried to go underground. That was my other one. It was called Three Forms of ID. And I thought that was a much better story. But anyway, so I just cracked on and tried to do it. And so that book was written when my daughter was between 6 months old and I think perhaps a bit over one. So very hard to do.
Wow.
That's the dedication in the book, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about motherhood because actually I went back and read your interview with the wonderful Rachel Power in Divided Heart, Motherhood and Creativity, and I've read and gifted that book to creative new mothers so often. And in it there's a couple of things that I wanted to raise from that. The first is that Rachel describes in her introduction how she thinks, oh, Kate Kennedy, immediately that she wants to talk to you. And then she realises at the time when she first wanted to talk to you that at that time you in fact didn't have a child. And this incredible sadness that comes as she realises your complicated and painful history with miscarriage. And so first off there's a section in there where you talk about the big unspoken vacuum in the literature about birth and parenting, about miscarriages. And last night I re-listened to you reading out for Radio National your poem Eating Earth that's in The Taste of River Water. And I wondered if you just wanted to talk about that, either the poem or writing into that vacuum.
Yeah, well, at the time, I think it's a little bit different now. There has been a little bit more sort of, I don't know, including of the idea of miscarriage and baby loss into the kind of stories people like to tell. And there's also going to be, obviously, other incorporations. We're going to be talking soon about our abortions and so on as part of our collective stories of what women experience and what we go through, I suppose. And at the time, there was something of a void, I must say. I think I wrote in the book, everyone talks about, oh, my IVF story or my adoption story or my, you know, twin story. But no one was talking about my miscarriage story. And yet it was so common. And I knew that it was so common that one in three pregnancies at that, you know, early pregnancies end in miscarriage. And yet it's just kind of incorporated. And the more people that found out about it, the more they would say, oh, yeah, that actually, you know, my mum, that happened to me too. In fact, once I was in hospital, after I had five concurrent miscarriages, and then I had my daughter, then I had a miscarriage after her. And one of my miscarriages was at 20 weeks. It was at 5 months. And I was in hospital after one of them. And I was in the ward with all the, at the time, the doctors thought I must have had an ectopic pregnancy. So my numbers were still very high, as they say. And I was in the hospital and it's kind of mixed ward. And middle of the night one time, there was this nurse sitting by my bed. And I said, oh, do you want to check my blood pressure or something? I was a bit groggy. I woke up and she was sitting there and she said, no, I just want to sit here. And then she just reached over and took my hand. And we just sat there for a minute. And then she said, it happened to me too, twice. It happened to me. And that's the way we kind of spent her shift. We're sitting there shedding a few tears with each other in this middle of the night sort of solidarity. And I think that's really what kind of struck me. That's pretty much how you get through things. Is you find other people who have had that experience too. And that's the way that we deal. So having those recurrent miscarriages with no explanation was a difficult experience. And I guess when I was writing that poetry book, I was very concerned that it wouldn't be when I say that it wouldn't be triggering, I don't quite mean triggering because I think art is a trigger. I think making art and actually being moved by art it propels us. It's a propulsive experience. There's a surge of recognition and energy, which is pretty much like squeezing a trigger. We do want to be propelled into those feelings. We do immerse ourselves again in feelings. So I don't quite want to say trigger, but I was concerned that people, when they started that section of the book, would understand that there's a narrative there. So please keep reading because the section begins with a death and ends with a birth. It has its own sort of shape. So it does a sort of a reversal of what happens in an ordinary life chronology, emotionally speaking at least. So it begins with those poems of coming out of that feeling. And I think in the poem it says it's like waking up is like going through a windscreen each morning. That there's that thing of other people have babies and you're asked to hold those babies and you're asked to celebrate the births of babies that happen the same time your baby would have been born and all of those things that you just have to carry around yourself. It's very hard to find the words for and it's very hard to be the person at the party who says, I have to go home now, sorry, I don't want to hold the baby. Or feeling kind of crazy that you want to go to the baby in the pram at the post office that's crying, whose mother's busy, and you want to lift it out and carry it out and leave. It's very weird what happens to you. And I think to be in that destabilized state is it's a good time then to be trying to write or make sense of it through writing. I certainly found that a lot of solace was making stuff. And I have to say, it really opened the floodgates to tons of other people who would write to me or contact me and tell me that was either their experience too, and it also gave them a lot of solace to kind of see it written into a narrative of the sort of the stages of grief and acceptance that happens, that we're not in control, that we're not as powerful as we'd like to be, that there is no answer for this. They just got to sit with that. And other people who bought it for their sisters and their friends who had experienced that too. So it was such a strange thing to kind of put that, I guess it's a hot coal, isn't it? You're juggling your own hot coal all the time and you're kind of a bit, I don't know, whether it's a shame thing or whether it's just a response of wanting to have your private life and your private griefs and experiences, something that you keep to yourself. But you're juggling and juggling and you realise everyone's juggling their own hot coals. We're all carrying around our hot coals. That's our incendiary material and that's the material that probably we owe it to ourselves to go to find that small hot centre that we can explore and at least deal with. And my way of dealing with it was writing those poems.
You talked about when we were looking at your bookshelves before, we were talking about poems and stories as gifts. And that feels like it was that kind of one that was a gift to particular readers too. There's talking about the narrative of it in that interview with Rachel Power, you go on to talk about and you write for her, or you are interviewed as you are nursing your new daughter.
Yeah.
And there's that aspect of it. What one of the quotes in that, and I'm going to quote it in full because I think it's so important, where she asks you about being a writer and a parent, you say, "This is one of the major ways being a writer and being a parent correlate to me. They are both full of invisible work, which is unacknowledged and unappreciated, which is absorbed without recognition into the fabric of everything you're trying to create at the same time."
Mm.
I want to ask you about that invisible work and how you've come to reckon with invisible work in your life.
Well, it's never as finely tuned and as important as it is when you're actually literally nourishing others from your own body and not through your words so much, but through, you know, your own sort of selfhood, your own time, your own space is you're never going to be first in your life ever again. That's, and in that way, I think becoming a parent or having the experience of looking after little kids in any kind of way, that way, it certainly makes you an adult, doesn't it? You know, it shows you the parameters of your own selfishness, I suppose, or what you're prepared to give up and where your boundaries might lie. And we're all different in that, of course, but just feeling totally subsumed in that world voluntarily, but also, you know, it's full on, isn't it? It's a full-time thing. And of course, as my daughters become older, and I've left that context of being in living on the farm and being in that relationship, and now she's just turned 17, my daughter. I do look at those poems sometimes, and I just think I need to write another collection. Now, you know,
yes,
I have written a few more about sort of motherhood and about watching her grow, and sort of my own mother has died in that interim, and I feel like that's a big stage as well.
Mm.
And I wrote a poem about when my daughter was in a little show with her school, her primary school, where they were doing Beatles songs and they were doing Here Comes the Sun. And they were all wearing these kind of hippie clothes from the 60s, and she came and got a scarf, one of my mum's scarves, out of my drawer and was putting it on. And my hands were itching to fix that knot. I can do it better. But she brushed my hand away. And I just had to just look at her do it herself, make a firm knot for herself in that scarf that still, of course, smelled like my mum's perfume. And I just thought, oh, my God, a lot of it is just trying to bite your tongue and get out of the way, isn't it, you know, to let them be the thing that perhaps you weren't allowed to be yourself. And so now that she's this much older, and I'm looking at the I just pre-ordered a book today, actually, a book called Hags about older women. Yeah, and how we tend to demonise and belittle women who are over sort of 45 or 50 and so on, because we can't see them as having that same sort of reproductive usefulness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet they still won't shut up, and so they start annoying us, you know.
Yeah.
And they've got all these opinions and they've got all these things, and we want to shut them down because they're kind of an uncomfortable truth or inconvenient truth, these older women. And yet older women, in my experience, run the world.
Absolutely.
If you walked out of here now and broke your ankle and I had to drive you down to casualty, who do you think would be there?
Yeah.
Who do you think's running the show?
Mm.
It's these older women who are just no nonsense, you know. They're out there now. They're out there doing stuff, keeping all the wheels on. And I guess I do see myself a little bit now as the sort of parent who is in the background just keeping the wheels on in that invisible way. But it's a hell of a lot easier now. And I'm really enjoying seeing my daughter come into her own space, not as an extension of me or anything to do with my expectations even. They are always subverted. Mm. You can give away that idea. What I feel like is, the other day I was saying to somebody, I feel like, you know that game curling, that sport curling where it's ice and the person, it's a strange sport, isn't it? There's a rock and someone's pushing the rock along on the ice. And if you pull back and look at the camera angle, there's two people or one person who's shuffling along before them, sort of trying to polish the ice just a little bit so that the trajectory of the stone is going to be smoother. No one's paying attention to that person.
Yeah.
But that's what I feel like I am. I'm the ice smoother who's out of camera shot in the curling competition.
That is a very bloody lovely metaphor, Kate Kennedy, as you are so very good at doing. You made me think then, I asked you, I'll let our listeners in on the behind the scenes of interview preparation, is that I messaged you yesterday and said, Kate, can you send me the speech that you did at Jacinta Parsons' launch for A Question of Age, which was launched last year, fabulous book, fabulous launch. And in it, you had just returned from a trip and you were on fire. And this speech you gave with your little key ring, yes, that barked out, no.
No.
Was so brilliant. But you gave me two versions, and one of them was more filled with rage, and it was the comedian, was it Tina Fey?
Tina Fey.
And that quote, which, yes, just struck me as what you were saying there.
She said something like, it's very hard in her business for women over the age of 50 to get work or be taken seriously. And she says, and I've been wondering why that is. We get called crazy. What is crazy, she said, in the world of television and film? What is this? Oh, joke with her. She's crazy. What is it to be crazy? She said, I think it's women over the age of 50 who you don't want to fuck them, but they still won't stop talking.
Yes.
Man, I am on that boat, please.
Yeah.
She's crazy. No, she's not. She's not this young, nubile, fertile, trophy,
yeah,
for some man,
yeah,
anymore. But even though she's past that, she still won't shut up.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes,
the hags. Please. That's a revolution. Revolution of hags. I want to here's some bits that I cut out, because what you did at this brilliant launch, which started with the gorgeous Monica Dux as well, and everyone was just in stitches basically the whole time.
There was all the women, who should explain, those women, yes, from all different decades of life.
They were.
And Jacinta did it very cleverly. She asked someone in their 20s, their 30s, their, yeah, 40s, 50s and their 60s to come and give a little launch push for,
yes,
her book.
For, yeah, her book.
For different eras of thoughts on aging.
And yours had the flavour of fuck it.
Menopause has, you know, it's made me think, I think it must be estrogen that leaves our body, and along with it goes that, oh, that's okay, I'll do it. Oh, they can't help it. Look, it's quicker if I do it myself. Oh, okay.
No worries.
That, I think that has kind of drained from my body with the estrogen. Now it's just like, I don't care. I don't care if I'm not a people pleaser anymore.
Has it been the most fabulous kind of inner revolution in your life, no longer being a people pleaser, Kate Kennedy?
Well, I think it's look, once the hot flushes, which probably are really rage related, begin to abate, you know, people do say, don't they, when people are rage does feel hot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It feels,
yeah,
hot and sweaty, and you're not rational, so you're a bit more dangerous. There is no, it's like the change that comes over you with adolescence, because it's all hormonal, isn't it? All,
yeah,
these things are like this massive kind of roller coaster. And it's like this sense of, you know, people say, oh, use that rage. It's fuel. It's like, I don't want to use the rage as fuel. That's awful. That feels like toxic fuel to me. It burns too hot. I'm not interested. That's not the hill I'm going to die on.
Yeah.
It's what I'm going to sit on. I'm sitting over here with a cup of tea, and I'm happy to be on the sidelines watching this stuff and not feeling like I need to be in the middle of something which is this massive churn of anger and rage. So I think there's a rage, but it doesn't do you any good, because women tend to turn their rage back on themselves,
yes,
it seems to me. And I don't want to have any more of that self-loathing or blaming myself for something or annoying myself by thinking, why didn't I, what an idiot I was, turn around so I can hit myself again. I just feel like, no, I'm fine actually. I don't have to please anybody. It doesn't matter to me that I'm actually invisible. That's good. It's good to be, it's like a invisibility cloak.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. I was at a poetry launch the other night for Hermina Burns, who was my old English lit teacher at high school, and she talked absolutely, her and Mary Crooks from Vic Women's Trust both talked about the power and strength of the invisibility cloak, as well as how,
I love it,
heavy it had been to carry at times.
It makes you less, not only are you no longer an object, which is a relief, you're not a subject. You're not the, what they call it, the lookism, you know, to be the viewed thing. It's like, I couldn't, you know, I really, I'm so, How much time have I wasted worrying about that stuff?
I opt out.
When people say, what would you tell yourself, you know, at 16, or you're asked to go and do something and give a little talk and it says, well, what would you tell yourself at 18? I just feel like saying, keep that bikini on, baby, and don't take it off until you are 35 because you are stacked.
What have you got better at in the narrative of Kate Kennedy, the writer? And what, if anything, do you feel is as difficult as the first time you started writing?
Well, I'm still stuck on unfinished projects because I still feel like I find it hard to say no to other writers who would like me to assist them or read their work or give them a hand with something or put together
talk
a workshop.
Talk on their podcast.
That's right. It's kind of hard because it's not like it's onerous. It's actually a kind of a pleasure.
Yeah.
And it is it's like the 10% of our social life when we live and work by ourselves. I don't think all writers are necessarily hermits who can't socialise. I think a lot of us are quite gregarious and we like it on a glass of wine and we like having a good laugh.
Don't take me to the pub.
And I like being out in the world where that's where I'm sort of picking up stories. I don't think that I'm that interesting, frankly. I don't think I'm the eternal well of inspiration. So me being at home by myself, I don't think it really is that productive. I'd love to be at home reading, but I probably would like to be walking down to the pub somewhere fun, ready to hear something that's going to start a story. So I need to be a bit better at saying no and saying, you know, yes to myself, which I don't really like seeing as kind of, oh, that's just self-care. I just sort of see it as I've got a lot of things I still want to write about and explore, and I want to get fit again in that way. Because it is a kind of like, it is like being fit, isn't it? The writing muscle, you can feel yourself getting a stitch sometimes, or you get puffed out too quickly or something, and it's easier to go and get another cup of coffee or to go and do something else that's waiting. And there's always stuff that's waiting to be done. There's a life that is demanding a lot of you. But really, I'm pretty happy with, you know, I guess I'm happy with the old media, which is not the time sink media. I'm happy with the books, music, good, you know, good TV and good movies, seeing the odd play, hanging out with friends. I'm happy with the kind of really analog stuff that is, you know, rewarding and interesting for me. I don't have to get too much into the very online, which is good. I don't have that thirst to do it. It's entertaining, but not that entertaining, you know. I'd much rather be doing something else. So I feel like I'm getting a bit better at that and enjoying. I'm looking forward to this sense of this next decade of my life, which is just I'm 60 in a week or two.
Ah!
And it's that feeling of I'm getting a decade to myself now. My daughter's good. My life's in order. I've got a lot that I want to get up and think, what am I going to look at today? And it's something that's creative that puts me in that beautiful state of that gentle hum, which is just the best feeling to be making something. I want to be a maker, not a consumer. And that's always been the itch. You know, I talk about if you've got an itch. When I was a kid, that was the itch. I wanted to make stuff. And that's what charges me up and look at other writers who are doing great things and other artists who are doing great things. It makes me feel charge that there's an exchange of energy happening, which is the only currency really that still interests me. I think that it's that when you walk into that exhibition or you open that book, does that thing give you energy or does it take your energy away? That's my rule of thumb of whether it's a good piece of art or not.
That's brilliant. Okay, delightfully, Kate Kennedy has reminded me of one of the many questions I skipped over, which was to ask her to read a poem, and here she is.
This one. It's about our conversation today too, about that rage and about finding your own bit of solace, I guess. This is called DIY Flat Pack Therapy. Everything I needed to learn about how to survive divorce, I picked up through sheer necessity, effortlessly packed and stapled, factory fresh from IKEA, disguised as bookshelves. First, they're awkward and heavy. To be manhandled, note that word, into the back of the car alone and driven to an otherwise empty house where the new key still catches in the lock of your throat. Marshal that fury of dragging them inside unassisted and slicing the boxes open with a new blade. Precision will help you channel the rage. See the instructions. See the drawing suggesting not to attempt this without a friend. Put on your glasses to check you have the correct number of small wooden plugs and screws. Open a bottle of wine. Charge up your drill. Lay the pieces out like an argument. Straddle each unit, holding them in place with your own knee. Remember kneeling to pull a suitcase out from under a marital bed? Your ex saying, okay, go. Nothing's ever good enough for you, is it? Your ex saying, and take all those useless books you keep buying. Fit the drill bit to the screw and squeeze, methodical and grim. So little pressure is necessary in the end. Follow the steps. Stand them up. Balance with chocks, then affix to the walls at right angles, determined by your new spirit level and stud finder. Make this empty room fuller and somehow smaller. IKEA has sold 60 million units of these. You are not special. You are one of millions. Neither are you the only woman in the world to start again with white laminated flat packs. Knees hurting on new floorboards. Learning that a lot of this is not hard, only tedious. Survey your handiwork humming. Transformation is possible. Stand there, swinging your drill like a goddamn boss. I wept putting these books into boxes, but not taking them out again. My hands ache in a different way. I have made something load-bearing. Kondo says to hold and interrogate each saved object to assess whether it gives you joy. Well, fuck you, Maria. I'm past joy. What I want are walls surrounding me like a hive, each saved spine visible and promising reconstruction, each cavity a thrumming nucleus cell. There will be no blank spaces. There will be nothing but stored nourishment. Let me seal the door with propolis. Let me hunker down and see out winter, sipping honey on every page.
Fucking bravo, Kate Kennedy. I love it. Kate Kennedy, we've returned to sit in your gorgeous lounge from an adventure around Castlemaine.
Hunter-gatherer foraging adventure.
We just finished with some op shopping, my favourite pastime. You came away with some books. I came away with some clothes. We also went past the mill.
We did.
I also bought something there.
We checked out the Shed Shaker, the tap room, which is a brewery here where we have lots of literary events. I'm hoping that you'll come up one day, Kate.
Yes.
That's run by Northern Books. We have a few literary in conversations there.
We had amazing coffee under a chandelier.
Dust Cafe House.
Yes, that was brilliant. I loved that.
The fabulous vintage bazaar we went to, which if you have visited Castlemaine, you'll know that it's just this fabulous place full of every kind of thing you can imagine.
Anything you could want.
Yes, literally from all different eras.
Anything you could want. And before that, we were at Lot 19. Yes. Which you described yourself, was that someone else's description as yes. Montsulvat meets Mad Max?
Exactly. I asked the owner and kind of operator of Lot 19 one time, Mark Anstey, how would you describe the aesthetic here? And he said, I'm looking for Montsulvat meets Mad Max. And I thought, and you have done it.
You have nailed the brief. And the reason we were there is because I very delightfully got let in to see your extraordinary new exhibition or exhibition that you have collaborated on called Return. Can you just tell us a little bit about that exhibition and that work?
I collaborated with the great photographer Helga Salve. Last year we went on a road trip from Mallacoota up to Bundanon in southern New South Wales. And we went up the coast. And basically Helga had been to Mallacoota just a couple of days after the 2020 fires and had taken lots of photographs then of the bush in its sort of incinerated state. So we started our trip there because we're interested in just following our noses, just to see how nature, and I guess in a way what we discovered also sort of human ecosystems, I suppose, were trying to recover and re-establish themselves after natural catastrophes and also after our 2 years of being inside, being cut off from nature really, with COVID. And so we had this great trip of just looking at the way that bush and coastal bushland is regenerating itself and the way that we visited lots of artists and photographers on the way, and then we stayed eventually up at Bundanon, which is Arthur Boyd's place, and worked there and talked and thought and took pictures and took notes and found quotes. And we just came back and put together this exhibition called Return, which is, I guess, about nature's amazing power to regenerate itself, and maybe the possibility that we as humans could do that too.
What is extraordinary about both the work and then the ensuing discussion which you and I had, which unfortunately, sorry, first-time listeners, you don't get to be privy to all the discussions, but the nature of your collaboration, there is sculpture mm-hmm. involved in that, there's photography, there's mm-hmm. your words, and there's also music.
That's
where
right.
You've collaborated with another musician, and the way that you have talked about things today is a little like, I think you used the word vector, being a vector between different artists and organisations to make things happen. Just what does that kind of artistic collaboration mean to you?
Well, A, it gives me a lot of pleasure to do that, I suppose. And also, in collaboration, you know, we get so used to working entirely by ourselves, don't we, as writers. You're alone in your room talking to your imaginary friends most of the time, basically. And when you do something where you collaborate, I like to feel that sense of initial resistance that you're losing control a bit of this vision that you're used to working with independently and it's 100% yours and so on, and that you're kind of working away on your little hoarded ideas. Sometimes I think it's good for us to kind of, you know, fish our little treasures out of our purse and say to someone else, what would you do with this? What are we going to do? They make it different. And they make it different to the way that you could ever imagine had you just worked by yourself. Mm. So collaboration shows you something of your own limitations, but also it's the beautiful surprise, the dopamine hit of surprise, that it's better than you could have made alone. We do better with each other than we do by ourselves in many ways. And I think that the exhibition really shows that, you know, nature's just busy getting on with trying to recover. And we're the ones dragging the chain, us humans. And so we thought, let's collaborate. So we asked a sculptor friend of mine from Dalesford, Miriam Porter, to please bring some of her sculptures. She sculpts birds and she makes big nests, and she's got some wombats there and a cockatoo that she's carved, and just some beautiful things. And then I asked a musician that I know who I've worked with before called Jen Lush from South Australia. She's a great singer and songwriter, and a lot of her stuff is on Spotify. And a few years ago, she put together an album called The Night's Insomnia, where she asked various Australian poets if she could please use some of their words to make this album of music. And once again, I was so surprised and happy to see that the poem became something so much better than it was on the page when it became this piece of music that is much more of an earworm, you know what I mean? It's much more moving and beautiful, and it shifts, its meanings kind of shift and morph. So I asked Jen again if she would like to take some lyrics of mine and I could be that vector to say, do whatever you want with these words. And she came back with this beautiful 10-minute atmospheric piece of music where suddenly those words have become lyrics. Mm. And now suddenly there's some sound effects of sort of birds and everything in the bush and waves that I recorded when I was away that are now part of that soundtrack. So people can come in and listen to that soundtrack as they're looking at those words walking around the exhibition, because I found it quite hard to incorporate text with images. Mm. How do you do that without being a bit didactic? Mm. I don't really like the caption, you know, phrases. So there's some words there, and there's some words hanging up, and there's some beautiful images. There's Miriam's beautiful pieces, which can't help but be image-rich and symbol-rich. And then there's this beautiful soundtrack. So it's a real kind of feast for the senses that's so different than it would be had I just stayed alone in my room and thought about what thing I wanted to write about.
The dopamine hit of surprise. I love it.
That's when we learn, when we're surprised, I think. That was what gives us that. It's finishing something and letting ourselves be surprised by it. Mm. I would so much rather feel that surprise than all the kind of pride in how well I have. I like to be outside my comfort zone and think, wow, look what happened. And then it feels finished. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And I have to trust that it's maybe going to surprise someone else in the same way as well. But there's nothing as good as that feeling. I think your brain remembers it. Mm. And next time you go back to the desk, maybe it's just that little bit less awful, a little bit less onerous, because you want to get to the end to have that feeling again.
We began with books today, and far
guess
from
what I found at the op shop,
getting rid of any books, you have bought some more books home. Just tell us, when Kate Kennedy goes to one of her local op shops, because there's a few in town, what does she pick up? What strikes your fancy?
Well, it's such a cornucopia of delight. I have Ali Smith's How to Be Both.
Excellent.
Amanda Lowry's The Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
I have the wonderful Fable Perret's book, There Was Still Love.
Such a great one.
With a blurb from my great friend Sarah Winman, which, a beautifully crafted book from a wonderful storyteller. It sings with humanity. I think maybe I'm the vector of that, that relationship too.
Oh, I'm so glad you are. And I think maybe you're involved in the vectorness of my relationship with Sarah Winman, which is only very slight, but I think you were the vector in there as well.
And last of all, just to kind of round out a lovely day of thinking about books and celebrate, I found a book called To Kill a Mockingbird, Cocktails with a Literary Twist.
I am so impressed, and I feel that we have also been during...
Do you feel like 100 Beers of Solitude? The Old Man and the Seagrams?
I see where this is headed, and I feel like that you will have to host some kind of literary party in the pond that we have also been watching take form today in your backyard.
A cocktail dangling our feet in the water. Doesn't that sound just perfect? The writing life, folks. It's just
that's exactly
it's
what
just
we
pleasure
do.
After pleasure.
We just sit around drinking cocktails in the pond. Before I finally let you go, can you please give us first the piece of advice? You're teacher, you're much sought after as a mentor, so I know you have to give lots of advice, but what's the one piece of writing advice you would like to pass on?
Wow, if only there was just one. I think, you know, it sounds a bit glib, but keep going. Mm. The map is made by the walking, I think. You can't plan in your head where it's going to take you, not in a good organic way. We're all just kind of cartographers on some massive map, and we're all finding our own path through. You are going to discover your material by fumbling your way through, as it says in that poem, walking in the room and feeling around for the light switch. Mm. That's how we're going to spend our lives, I think. So keep going. It will make itself plain.
Keep going, she says. You heard it from Kate Kennedy. And finally, a recommendation of a debut book, anytime, any genre, and also with slight explanations, if one desires.
I love the Canadian writer Lisa Moore and her debut short fiction collection, Degrees of Nakedness, which really knocked my socks off. So I've been reading another collection of hers called Something for Everyone, short story collection by Lisa Moore.
Excellent.
She lives in Newfoundland. And the book everyone seems to be reading and discovering, the beautiful small book by Irish writer Claire Keegan, author of Foster, which became The Quiet Girl, the movie. The book called Small Things Like These. It's small and gem-like, and I can't wait to get into it.
Thank you. Wonderful recommendations. And Kate Kennedy, I cannot thank you enough for your warmth and generosity and wisdom sharing. It's been an absolute delight.
It's been a delight to have you here for the day. Thanks, Kate.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.